From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It takes about a decade to grow a productive pecan tree and a matter of minutes to take one down. A UGA specialist estimates that Hurricane Michael's 100-mile-an-hour winds left 75% of pecan crops unharvestable in several Georgia counties. Combined losses in the state's agricultural sector run around $2.5 billion. 5 months after the storm, many farmers are still picking up the pieces, and we've been periodically following up with growers since. Randy Hudson's family has run Hudson Pecan Company for more than 150 years, and he's on the line from Irwin County. Hello again, Randy.
Morning.
How you doing?
Better.
Well, glad to hear it. Rob Cohen owns Pecan Ridge Plantation. He's been in the family business for decades. He's joining us from Decatur County. Hello, Rob.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning to you. Randy, I'm going to start with you because earlier this month, you were there when Governor Kemp, our Agricultural Commissioner Gary Black, and other state leaders met with about 100 farmers in Tifton, Georgia. What kind of questions did farmers want answered?
Well, I tell you, farmers were wanting to know exactly where they could turn to try to get some support. It's that time of year again when growers are beginning to start farming all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Annual event where you try to get your financing in place and you start the process of planting, or in this case, spraying and getting ready to make your crop. And so with what happened and the devastation that we had, and the fact that so many of us are coming up considerably short on both our short-term and our long-term fixed notes, how we were going to get finance for the coming year. And so there was a lot of concern about financing and support that we have been told was in the process, and now we're at the point where decisions have to be made, and we're still looking for a lot of this support.
So any promises or timetables given at this meeting?
Well, you know, there's been, out of Washington, there's been some real difficulties in getting the legislation that was necessary in regards to disaster assistance, as well as some other programs, ECP or the program which allows us to clean up our orchards and then get everything ready for the coming year, have been a little slow coming. It's been tied up into political processes. But we feel like it's coming. We're very optimistic about it. But now Georgia has really stepped forward. I've got to commend both Governor Kemp, Commissioner Gary Black, and the Georgia legislature for what they have done. They stepped up. They stepped up immediately. Quite honestly, they've done more than I ever thought they possibly could do, considering the state of the of our economy and reserve programs, but Georgia has really stepped up to help its pecan growers.
Well, just to clarify, shortly after Hurricane Michael, President Trump did address Americans and assured the farmers that the government would work quickly to help them and others after the storm. But the appropriations bill passed in February did not include aid from an earlier bill. How about you, Rob? You're a little further south in Decatur County, where the impact was even greater. What did you see? How's your recovery going?
Well, our recovery is coming along very slowly. We were reduced from about 1,400 acres to about 500 acres of standing trees. Mm. And on those 500 acres, we're probably going to have to take down another third of those remaining trees just because they're so they were so devastated from the storm. So we have almost been completely wiped out of the pecans. I do commend our state representatives and our Senate. They have really stepped up and seem to be leading the charge to help us in our area of the state devastated. You know, not only us, but the timber people and the row crop people that were devastated by the storm. So, you know, we're still in the final stages of cleanup. I was unable to purchase trees this year to set back because I'm so unsure about financing and short-term and long-term debt that we owe. So we're holding up to kind of see what kind of help we get from the state and possibly federal money to help us set these orchards back out.
Well, the state did allocate millions for the cleanup and tax credits and loans. This was during a special session after the storm. $55 million in loan funding has already run out. Were either of you able to refinance farm loans for your businesses?
We have done some refinancing, yes.
How about for you, Randy?
No, it was such a small pot of money, and quite honestly, we were really on the edge. We didn't lose but about 5,000 trees.
Mm-hmm.
Rob probably lost that many acres. I mean, that many trees in one orchard. But
yeah.
We were not able to get into that pool. It was a very small pool of money considering the total amount of damage that had occurred. So we did not get any low interest monies, but we are hoping to get into some of these other rounds and maybe get some support.
Now, Randy, you were also hit with a hailstorm and a tornado this month. I mean, your family's been in the business for a long time, so you've been hit by storms in the past. How long does it generally take to come back?
Well, pecans, it can take as much as 20 years, but I tell you, you brought up a subject here which is pretty dear to me, and being agriculturalist and watching years and decades of history in regards to the weather, farmers are probably the next best weathermen they are out there. They pretty well follow the weather, but we went 25 years and only had one tornado in 25 years. In the last 3 years, we've had three hurricanes and we've had three tornadoes, and even this past week, we had a very small tornado that came over Osceola, Georgia, high, but it did drop golf ball size hail and just destroyed my house, roof, and my barn, and any vehicles that were sitting outside. So this weather pattern has got us very concerned, and actually it's changing the way we grow pecans to a much smaller tree, much shorter tree. But, yeah, we're very concerned about the weather, and it seems like it continues to get, to be bad. And now all we expect next is the locust to show up.
Followed by the frogs. I'm speaking with the pecan grower, Randy Hudson. That's him just speaking. And Rob Cohen is also with us. Randy's in Irwin County. Rob in Decatur County. Now, Rob, you did have crop insurance. Did it cover your losses from Hurricanes Irma before Michael and Michael? And what does that cover?
Well, our crop insurance is revenue type policy. That's all we carry. We don't carry the policy that covers the actual tree itself because it's entirely too expensive. And that is one thing I hope that the federal government will step in and try to fix it to where a grower can afford the insurance on that actual tree. But the revenue coverage is only coverage for the revenue that crop, that acre will produce in that calendar year. So and with Irma, it kind of scraped by us. I think Mr. Randy and them got more of that storm the previous year. But we didn't harvest any pecans in 2018 due to the impact of the storm. So yes, if it wouldn't have been for the crop insurance revenue plan, we would be completely out of business. That did save we were able to pay back our inputs and basically go one more year in the hopes that things will be better in 19.
Well, when this happens, our banks and lenders, some of them probably from your own community, maybe some from other places, long and short-term loans, are they forgiving? Will they work with you?
Yes, for the most part. The bank that we deal with is Southwest Georgia Farm Credit, and from the day after the storm, my banker called me, assured me that they would do anything and everything in their power to help us get through this situation that we're in. And so far, yes, they have been more than generous to help work with us. Absolutely.
Now, Randy, I think when we first spoke, you had talked about the tariffs or the trade wars up and down, those tensions that began last summer. You may not have even had any orders, because China used to be a big buyer. Now President Trump says he's still a few weeks away from a trade deal with China. What do you want to see in that final agreement?
Well, obviously, we'd like to see zero tariffs on pecans. I think Rob and I both would love to see that. And along those lines, I'd like to just mention this. We already had a disaster shaping up in the pecan industry before Hurricane Michael came. In fact, I had already notified my insurance company that if, in fact, we had to face a 47% tariff, looking at our historical marketing and the prices we've been paid, even in the absence of a hurricane, we were looking at probably marginal losses just on price basis. And that came to fruition. In fact, soon after the retaliatory tariffs came into effect, the price of pecans fell by over $1 a pound,
poor
level. So Rob and I both, well, every pecan grower in Georgia lost $100 million before Hurricane Michael got here.
Absolutely.
And then when Hurricane Michael came, people like Rob had lost 75% of their farms and all of their production. Not only were they hit with the tariff issue, also they were hit by Hurricane Michael. I don't know which was worse on us, Hurricane Michael or the tariff. I do know this. In the last few weeks, the price of pecans had gone up considerably. China has moved back into the market, and we're seeing a real rally in the pecan market. In fact, most of the big pecans in Georgia that would go to China, any of the supply that was out there now is either on its way to China or getting prepared to go to China. We're actually out, my company actually is out in Texas today trying to buy pecans. So that's good news. That's real good news.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because it seems like y'all, you know, in rural Georgia keep getting hit with challenges between the weather, now job losses. We hear about a lack of access to doctors and school closings and tariffs. So Randy, how are you dealing with all this stuff, and how's your community dealing with it?
Well, I mean, let's just put it on a community basis, and let's just take pecans just as an example. That didn't include all of these real high-value crops like peanuts and cotton, but if you take pecans alone, in Georgia, we normally will produce around 100 million pounds of pecans. You take $1 a pound off 100 million pounds, you got $100 million. And then if you use the economics, the Remy model, whatever model you use, that dollar gets passed around in rural communities anywhere from 4 to 5 times. So that $100 million has, in essence, about $500 million worth of impact in rural Georgia. So you take that $500 million out just on pecans, plus take Michael, and what you've got down here is, well, it's not necessarily recession. We're probably in stagflation because, you know, we're being stripped right now of literally millions and millions of dollars in rural Georgia economic activity. So the real effect is still being trickling. I guess it'd be trickling up because we're not paying taxes, but for sure, Rob and growers like ourselves, we're in a real dilemma right now. Like I said, we're just sitting here waiting on locusts and frogs to show up.
Well, we're out of time, but Randy, I understand you've been growing your hair since October, and you're not going to cut it until everything is cleared up. I really hope next time we speak, you've got a nice little crew cut going on.
Well, it won't be a crew cut, but I tell you, my wife and my family says I look pretty ragged.
Pecan grower Randy Hudson.
It was blown over, it's in the woods, so it's side the way, and I can't see it.
Well, if you start braiding it, we're in big trouble. I want to thank you, Randy Hudson, and Rob Cohen. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. Hi, Rob.
Have a great day.
All right, back with more on Second Thought right after the break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Domestic violence and sexual assault are the leading causes of injuries for young women and girls over the age of 15 in Georgia. That's according to the state's Department of Public Health. Here to talk about this frequently overlooked problem is Michelle White. She's child and youth manager for the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you.
So by the CDC's count, 1 in 4 women in the U.S. report experiencing intimate partner violence before the age of 18. Now, what falls under that definition?
Sure. There's a lot of different components related to power and control in an intimate partnership when we think of intimate partner violence. One of the most common is recognizing physical violence in a relationship, but there's also verbal abuse, emotional abuse, digital abuse that's happening, especially with the increase in social media.
Digital abuse meaning sexting or bullying?
Absolutely. That would fall under that. Having power and control over someone with using technology say they're going through your emails, invading your privacy, excessive text messaging, things of that nature. Also, over 90% of people who experience intimate partner violence experience financial abuse. Again, that same narrative of having power and control over someone financially. You're preventing someone from going to work. You're stealing their resources. You're threatening them if they go to their job and things of that nature. So really, when we think of intimate partner violence, it's one person having power and control over another person and trying to maintain that power and control.
But teen dating violence is looked at as a separate category. So first of all, why and how is that defined?
Sure. It's a lot to do with age. So with our young people, you know, I always like to tell folks, remember when you were a teenager and really think about when did you first start learning about relationships? Biologically, chronologically, you don't have that much experience with dating. And so that's a lot. That's a big component with teen dating violence. It has to do with our young people. You know, teens are really engaged in independence and sometimes less trustful of adults. So that's something that's included with that teen dating violence as well. It's also really difficult to tell if you're experiencing dating violence in that relationship because of those former components. There's a lot of elements of stalking. Again, that digital abuse component with social media usage that comes up for teens. A lot of controlling behaviors show up for teens as well in dating violence that sometimes is masked as romantic and protective. Something we've seen a lot with teens is they'll have their partner say, well, I love you so much, so I don't think you should hang out with your friends. You should hang out with me. Or I love you so much. You know what? Let me go through your phone, make sure that everything's okay. So there's this like protectiveness that sometimes is masked as actually power and control in a relationship.
And misread as affection.
Absolutely.
Right. A few years ago, the organization Love is Respect ranked Georgia number one in the country for teen dating violence. This research is now considered outdated. Do you have any numbers on the problem today?
It's about one in three, and of course, that's what is reported. And a really big barrier to teen dating violence is it's significantly underreported. A lot of teens are not sharing that they're experiencing dating violence, or they're not sure that they're experiencing dating violence and therefore cannot report what they don't know. But what we've seen as of now, it's about one in three teens that do report that they're experiencing dating violence share that they are.
Who are they likely to report to? Teachers, parents, what?
Wouldn't that be great if it was teachers and parents?
Well,
most likely it's their peers. Their friends are probably their peer group is the number one folks. If they decide to share that they're in dating violence relationship, they're talk to their friends about it.
So I want to dig into what you were talking about. Like, people may not understand that this is actually abuse. And Pew Research Center says roughly one third of American teens have been in some sort of relationship. As you said, these are formative relationships. But is it likely that a teen who would endure abuse might have suffered or witnessed abuse at home? In other words, it feels normal to them.
Absolutely. There's definitely a component where if you've witnessed, if you've been exposed to intimate partner violence as a child, there's definitely a connection to you experiencing dating violence. And that's not for all folks, but you can definitely connect that to experiencing dating violence as you get older. Sometimes for teens, that's the norm. Right? They're learning about relationships in childhood. They may see violence in relationships and may think that's what relationships should be. Again, that's some teens, not all teens, but that's definitely a component of it.
So they might not recognize this as abuse.
Absolutely. And again, a lot of times what we're seeing, we're getting a lot better now, but a lot of times we see that physical violence is what is defined as violence in a relationship, when really there's a lot of more subtle, less physical components to that. Again, we're talking about verbal abuse, mental abuse, emotional abuse, psychological abuse, sexual abuse, right? We talk a lot about consent and what goes on between teens. We're talking about sexting is another component of it, not having control over what's going on with your body, being exposed to things you don't want to be exposed to. All of that falls under the umbrella of dating violence.
And are those prosecutable offenses? Sexting, for example?
I believe so. I don't have the exact numbers on that, but I know that that's something that people who are under 18 are actually, that impacts legally what they're allowed to do.
So what could be some warning signs for teens that they could be in an abusive relationship?
Sure. One of the biggest things, I like to give big picture ways of looking at it. If you notice you're not having freedom in your relationship, you notice you're feeling controlled or that you're not allowed to do something, right? It may start off as someone feeling like they're protecting you and loving you and taking care of you. But if you notice you actually don't have choices in your relationship, that you feel like you're walking on eggshells with your partner, that you feel if you say something or do something or wear a certain thing, hang out with a certain friend, you know that's going to upset your partner, even though you have the right to do that. Notice those signs and trust your gut. If you notice something's happening, our bodies rarely lie to us. So notice in your body, you know, I don't think this is right. And if you feel comfortable, talk to a trusted friend. Ideally, we would love our adults to be more informed on what dating violence is. I want to say over 80% of adults, when they hear about dating violence, they actually don't believe their teens when they say that something's going on in their relationship. So I would love for our adults out there that are listening, when teens are explaining to you the concerns they're having in their relationship, try your best to listen and take their concerns seriously.
So if they aren't speaking with you, as you said, maybe that's the ideal, a parent or a teacher would be informed. What might an adult or a parent be looking for?
Sure. What an adult can see is if they notice that their child or their child friend, again, is not able to have that freedom in their relationship, if they're being isolated, that's a huge component of dating violence and domestic violence, right? They're being removed from their friends. They notice a lot of teens like to use the word ghosting their friend. They're not able to be in their friend groups. They're not able to participate in extracurricular activities. They have to devote, and I use that word have to, right, to maintain that relationship and maybe that safety. They have to maintain their relationship with this partner. If you notice the other partner showing up in random places, like you said you were going to the movies, you put that on Twitter, all of a sudden your partner is there, right? Those are elements of stalking. But you want to notice those behaviors and begin to have a conversation with teens about it. Like, hey, I noticed such and such. Did you notice that too? Really just trying whatever you can to open that conversation. It'll be up to that teen to disclose, but man, it makes it so much easier when adult notices those elements of dating violence and they can just begin that conversation.
And three women and one in four men experience some form of domestic violence. That's what the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence found. And so chances are good that everyone knows someone who's been affected. You talked about parents and families modeling relationships, but portrayals of abusive relationships are really prevalent in pop culture. Here's just a little bit from the trailer for the new Lifetime series, You, starring Penn Badgley.
I just need to know who you really are. You are special. You're talented. You're passionate. You're smart. But you have questionable taste in friends. Professor Obvious wants to sleep with you. There are scary people in the world. It's important to be safe. All I want to do is help. It's why I have to do what I'm about to do.
Michelle White is with us. She's child and youth manager for the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And we're talking about teen dating violence in Georgia. It's something that tends to go under the radar. So, Michelle, what do you hear there? What aspects of abuse?
What a great example. I'm so glad you guys found that clip. What we hear and what we see in that particular clip is this romanticized view of being protected by someone. That is an excellent show to watch to talk about dating violence because, again, it portrays a lot of things that we like about being in relationships, being seen, being taken care of, being protected. But spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the show, I've seen it. There's a lot of elements of what's happening with that perpetrator of violence where he is stalking, invading this person's privacy, breaking into her social media accounts without any of her consent or her permission. Again, those are things that are not healthy, things that you're not allowed to do in your relationship when it's healthy. So it's great to see those things and to call them out. Even that actor in particular has said, hey, this is actually not a guy who's following the law. He's got some issues because there's, again, that romanticized view of that being protected and taken care of that a lot of us enjoy.
Well, maybe those kinds of examples are more compelling to watch, but do we see examples or can you give us some signs of what a healthy relationship looks like, what a sort of normal amount of control or autonomy would look like?
Absolutely. So elements of healthy relationships, when your boundaries are respected, is a really big one. When you say something, thing, you stand in it, and the person you're in a relationship with respects that. When you're able to have open and honest communication where you don't feel like you have to walk on eggshells with someone, when someone respects your consent, especially in sexual spaces, they're not coercing you to do things or manipulating you to do things. And again, when you are allowed to have that independence and freedom in your relationship, something that a lot of us really enjoy is having our independence. And if you notice that you're able to do things, able to live your life, have your friends and your family, and that's not threatened or taken away from you, and you're not being isolated from your support systems.
I think we have a lot of, especially for the teenage brain, we know they're not well-developed. They're not sort of connected to the frontal lobe yet in a very direct way. So there is some diminishment of reasoning, or that's not fully developed, let's put it that way. And there's a tendency to believe that dramatic, high drama in relationships is actually a sign of love. Do we get a lot of examples of that? Is that part of the problem?
That's such a good question. And I think that there's a lot of sensationalism, especially when you're watching reality TV shows or if you're looking at small clips on Instagram or Twitter or Snapchat that really focus on that element of relationships. I think it's helpful for us to continue to talk about what is a healthy relationship because we have so many examples of that in our media today, but it's hard to find.
Well, the Columbus Ledger Enquirer recently reported on several cases that started as teen dating violence. So we have a look at the trajectory here because they later escalated into domestic violence-related fatalities. The victim in one of the cases, 18-year-old Destiny Virgin, died in September after her ex-boyfriend shot her repeatedly. Now, this was on a public road. Over the last decade, gunshot deaths have been the cause of death in 73% of Georgia's domestic violence death. So what is this relationship between guns and domestic violence among teens?
I think that's huge with dating violence and domestic violence. And the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence is definitely doing their best to see what we can do about that relationship between gun violence and dating violence. But there's an accessibility to it. It sounds like from what we've been learning about those, including that victim's murder, that there's an accessibility factor to that. Young people are able to get their hands on guns for these fatal moments. And they are getting it illegally, legally. They're able to find these guns and to use them in that capacity. So we're still doing our work to see what can we do to really limit that.
Well, the specter of fear and violence together are a mighty combination. So if somebody does recognize that they're experiencing teen dating violence, they might think, I can't break up with this person. Then things are really going to go badly for me or for my family or for others. How can we defuse that kind of a situation?
Sure. The idealistic approach we want to start with is really just talking about what dating violence is so that more teens know what it is and know what to do to look for it. We also want to open those lines of communication. A lot of people experiencing dating violence and domestic violence are shamed and sometimes blamed for experiencing that violence. Sometimes you'll hear, well, what did you do to cause that? Or why did you make him so mad? You know how he is. I like to say, do your best to limit those conversations. It's actually not helpful. It's not helpful to that person trying to survive that dating violence that is happening to them. So as a friend, as a family member, do your best to listen and offer to talk about safety planning strategies with them. And for teens in particular, you want to talk about where they are with their perpetrator of violence, talking about safety planning in schools, in the community, in their place of work, things like that.
How about in schools? Are teens taught to protect themselves from these kind of situations in sex ed curriculum in Georgia or other information on healthy and unhealthy relationships?
Sure. There's a wonderful organization called the Georgia Teen Advocates Network that actually hosts our youth and teen advocates that go in the community, specifically in schools, to talk about healthy relationships. This is a growing network of folks who are able to provide that healthy relationships curriculum in schools. And you can definitely connect with us to learn more about it. But in terms of safety planning in schools, really talk to that teen about what they're experiencing in terms of violence. If they know, hey, safety planning strategies could be, oh, if you notice that my shirt is hanging out of my locker and I'm not able to make it to third period, tell the school counselor. You know, just getting creative in terms of those strategies to talk about what that teen is experiencing and how they can provide communication so that they can be safe.
One question before we close. Legally, can a teen get a restraining order or press charges for domestic violence in Georgia?
They can, but they can't do it alone. They need an adult that's over the age of 18 to petition on their behalf.
Okay, so, you know, as we're closing here, how do you get through to a teen on a topic like this when, as you said, they're becoming more independent and they want to believe they've got everything figured out?
Relationship. I think that when you're able to tell a teen that you really care about them and that you want them to be safe, whatever that looks like, you're opening the door to have that conversation.
Michelle White, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Michelle White is Child and Youth Manager for the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Now, we always like to hear from you if you missed any of today's show or if you'd like to listen on your own time. You can hit the Programs tab for On Second Thought at GPB News, and you can subscribe to the On Second Thought podcast so you'll never miss anything. And we also love to hear from you. You can join our conversations ongoing on Facebook group. This is a Facebook group, by the way, not a page, so just know that. It's GP Radio's On Second Thought. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. You can always email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Stay with us. GPB's Ross Terrell and Taylor Gant are going to join me for a dose of March Madness. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back after a short break with more of On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Atlanta native E.R. Anderson is executive director of Karis Circle. That's the nonprofit arm of the feminist bookstore, Karis Books. Here are Anderson's recommendations for our Southern Reading List, our series of authors and readers sharing books that define and reflect the South.
So my name's E.R. Anderson. I'm the executive director of Karis Circle, which is the nonprofit programming arm of Karis Books. And Karis Books is the nation's oldest independent feminist bookstore. So my first book pick is Flight Path, A Search for Roots Beneath the World's Busiest Airport. It's by Hannah Palmer. Hannah lives in East Point and grew up in a neighborhood that was raised to make the fifth runway at the Atlanta airport. And one of the things I love about this book is it's a deeply personal history of her family's sort of various homes, both the family, her biological family that she grew up with and the family that she's creating with her husband. But it's also just sort of her journey through all of the different ways that Atlanta like paves over history. There are so many parts of Atlanta that used to be neighborhoods, both like 75, 85, you know, many historically black neighborhoods were raised to make that interstate. I didn't know that a lot of historically white neighborhoods were raised to make the airport. And to think about sort of the ways that gentrification, the Olympics, and then city infrastructure, things like MARTA, all of those things have played major, major, major roles in shaping economic and racial stratification in the city, but also just like how people live, where people live, all those things. I'll just read you the opening line, which I think is gives you a sense of the personal and political. So despite protests from the Kirkwood Neighbors Organization and bad press in the local paper, they bulldozed the house where I lost my virginity. So it leads you right in. The next book I want to tell you about is Heavy. It's by Kiese Lehmann. Kiese Lehmann's one of my all-time favorite writers. It's a memoir. It's about his relationship to his mother. It's about his relationship to his body. It's very much about his relationship to white supremacy and money and all of these different forces kind of coming down on his family. It's very much, though, about how to tell the truth in a country that encourages us to lie. I read it all in one sitting. We were actually doing a readathon fundraiser for Karis, so I had pledged to read it back to back with a bunch of other books. So I read it in like 2.5 hours, and I cried 3 times reading it. I'm not like a giant crier, but I mean, he and I are very, very different. I am white and grew up in Atlanta with a lot of educational and economic privilege, but his relationship to his mother and the things that she wanted for him very much resonated with my own mom, who raised me, who really wanted me to get a PhD and really wanted me to have the kind of success that she didn't get to have. So the last pick I wanted to share with you is a little bit of an oddball pick, but the other books I offered are recent books from the last 2 years, and I wanted to bring my favorite old book about Atlanta. So Ann River Siddons' book, The House Next Door, was written in the 70s. I think it was 1978. It was written in 1978. It was her second book. Ann River Siddons, when I was growing up, was like the person that like my aunts and my grandma read. And so in my mind, she sort of existed in this like crusty, boring category that I was like, oh, that's not for me. Then I really love horror fiction, and so I read Stephen King's book about, his nonfiction book about horror. And in it, he said, the best haunted house story that nobody reads is The House Next Door by Ann River Siddons. And I was like, what? And I agree. So one of the things I would say, if folks got obsessed with The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix, you should totally read The House Next Door. Because I think it's the closest thing in literature, even though The Haunting of Hill House is obviously based on a book by Shirley Jackson, the TV show is so different from that. This book is much more similar to the TV show. And one of the things I love about it is that it is, it satirizes old money, Ansley Park, Buckhead, Atlanta, and is basically about the idea that in this sort of wealthy area around the High Museum, a new architect would come in, and instead of, you know, an old haunted house in some Victorian mansion, a new, brand new modern building would be erected that would destroy the fabric of the neighborhood, and that building would be the haunted house.
That was Atlanta native E.R. Anderson with Karis Circle. It's the nonprofit connected to feminist bookstore Karis Books. We use music from Blue Dot Sessions.
I love March!
Play your game, have some fun.
Now I gotta take it to a different level. This is a different level.
The thing that makes you guys special is you never quit.
We deserve to win this game.
Make history. Make history.
We kinda all wanted to be in the One Shining Moment video.
One, two, three! Yeah.
March Madness is upon us. The NCAA holds its men's and women's college basketball tournaments this month. A time for brackets and betting and the annual One Shining Moment video that we've been hearing. That's the 2018 edition. Well, it's also a good reason to hear from our in-house sports experts, GPB reporter Ross Terrell and Morning Edition producer Taylor Ganter here. They're going to talk us through the Georgia connections to this year's tournament. Hello, guys.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Good morning. Well, Taylor, I'm going to start with you. Georgia and Georgia Tech face some pretty solid competition this season, and they're not going to get a chance to win it all. But let's talk about who is at least representing the state. Georgia State made the brackets. The team finished number one in the Sun Belt Conference. So how did the Panthers play this year to earn this spot?
Right. So if you're a fan of immense underdogs, and this is the team for you, they're coming in, very, very highly seeded, or lowly seeded, I guess you could say. They won the Sun Belt Championship. That's how they got an automatic bid to play in the NCAA tournament. When you're in a smaller conference, you know, you don't usually get picked by the committee. You just earn a spot by winning your championship. So they're in. They're led by a player by the name of DeMarcus Simmons. So if you're looking for him, number 15 in blue and white. He averaged 18 points a game, and along with the rest of his team, they like to shoot a lot of three-pointers. So it's kind of the way that the NBA is going. It used to be about big guys, and now it's about Steph Curry, James Harden. Shoot as many threes as you possibly can and live with the consequences.
So Ross, in 2015, GSU was the 14 seed team facing number 3 Baylor, and then this happened.
He misses! Shipes the rebound!
Gotta push this to the basket. Take it to the basket, guys. 9 seconds!
No timeouts left.
What are they doing?
R.J. Hunter for three.
Good!
What's happening in this clip?
What you are hearing there is the madness of March. That is a underdog team. I think a game winner to knock off a number 3 seed. And that is why we love this time of the year, because you never know. I mean, nobody expects Georgia State to beat Baylor. Nobody expects Georgia State to beat Houston this year, and they probably won't.
And probably the most amazing part of that clip, are obviously our radio listeners can't hear it, the coach, Ron Hunter, is sitting on a stool because he tore his Achilles tendon celebrating the win before this one. So he's literally sitting on a stool. His son hits the game-winning shot to beat number 3 seeded Baylor. He's celebrating. He falls over. Harper. You know, they're trying to pick him up off the ground so they can play defense. It was truly amazing to watch.
So at least some family drama going on there. But the Sun Belt Conference in which GSU plays is not that competitive. So the Panthers are underdogs, as Taylor said, in the 14th seed again this year. They play third seed Houston on March 22nd. Could we see another surprise upset?
No. Not from them.
In the realm of possibility, anything is available.
It is possible, but we won't see it from them this year. We'll see upsets. But I think Houston is solid, and they are three. Georgia State, you got in, cool. Enjoy dancing while you're there.
They certainly have a shot. I'll put it that way. They got a shot.
Well, the men's teams were named for the tournament on Selection Sunday. Women's teams announced on Selection Monday. So just last night, we find out which schools made it. Any Georgia teams going to be on the court for women?
So once again, we have another long shot team representing Georgia. Would be the Mercer Bears, are coming in at a 15 seed. They're led by Kiki Calloway, number zero, if you're looking for her on the court. 18 points a game. She leads the team in the number of threes shot. But once again, as our cynic Ross Terrell would say, very big long shot against Iowa. They also play on Friday. So it's going to be a tough road for either one of these teams to make a buzz in this tournament.
All right. So on second thought, does reach listeners in South Carolina, Florida, Tennessee, Alabama, any teams from the region make the men's tournament?
The men's or women's?
Men's or women's.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the women's.
Good job.
South Carolina, they are a number four seed in the women's tournament. I actually have them going to the Final Four. They are a solid team. You've got the North Carolina and the men's bracket. You've got Kentucky. You've got Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Tennessee, I think, is one of the most complete teams in the tournament. So if you're within the region, pay close attention, because an NCAA victory could be coming back to our surrounding states.
Mm. Okay, so Taylor, we know football is traditionally the most popular sport here in Georgia. Where does college basketball rank when it comes to fans' interest?
So there was an interesting article in the AJC that came out, I believe, last week. It took a Wallet Hub study, and it found that the city of Atlanta, not speaking for the whole state now, but the city of Atlanta was 192nd when it came to cities for college basketball fans. That's a pretty crazy number. And it ranked off of things like fan participation and then team success. And so obviously, we really haven't had a lot of big-time winners. You know, for Georgia Tech, it was the early 2000s. They made it to a national championship game. And for Georgia, it was even longer back than that. I think it was the mid-90s. They made the Sweet 16. But it's been up and down. And when you have like your top two sports schools, you know, they're kind of all in on football right now. It's difficult to garner that kind of, interest and attention when the product's not that great.
Mm-hmm. So, but are there any other Georgia ties to the tournament? A star player born here, someone who used to coach here, someone who flew into Hartsfield-Jackson Airport once?
So I don't know what the connection is specifically with Kentucky, but there's two players there that were top high school athletes here in the state. Ashton Hagans, or Haggins if you prefer, he came out of Newton High School in Covington. He leads the team in steals and assists, and obviously Kentucky is a powerhouse. EJ Montgomery also plays for the team. He comes out of Wheeler High School in Marietta. And then just down the road over in Mississippi for Miss State, Reggie Perry, who played over in Thomasville, he is their top rebounder and very reliable player for them. So, you know, it's not like we don't create great basketball players here in Georgia. They usually just don't stick around.
Okay, so of course, March Madness, kind of like the World Cup for the Super Bowl or the Super Bowl, in that it brings in fans who might not watch during the regular season. So Ross, how far does the popularity of the tournament go in sparking broader interest in the sport, you think?
I think, you'll have a lot of eyes on it this year. There was a massive college basketball scandal in which the FBI was looking at coaches paying for players. So I think people are interested to tune in and see how those teams were affected, how they perform. It's also a lot of fun. The chances of having what we call a perfect bracket, meaning picking every game right, I think you have a better chance of being struck by lightning while winning the lottery. It just doesn't happen. And you're talking about millions of brackets being entered on ESPN. There are tons of groups, workplace competition. But I will say, back to your other question, Atlanta might want to get together because they are hosting the NCAA Final Four next year.
Mm-hmm.
And being 192nd might not look too great if we hope to bring it back.
Well, you know, this morning I was listening to Marketplace, and GPB's own Ricky Bevington had a story on Marketplace about how Major League Soccer is more popular than ever, and that the whole organization got together to to market it by by showing games from other countries, sort of stirring up the interest. Do you think maybe college basketball or basketball in general might be able to do the same kind of thing?
You know, potentially so. You know, I think it's a little more difficult because of the way that college basketball works nowadays, where you have a system where the top players, it's called the one and done, they come to college for 1 year because that's required before they move on to the NBA. So in places without a lot of, you know, history, like if you're a Duke or a Kentucky, then you have this really, you know, built-in fan base that's been following for years. But it's tough because if you do get a great player at you know, a school, say like Ben Simmons, who was the top pick a few years ago for LSU, they're gone the next year and whatever, you know, kind of momentum they brought goes with them. So, you know, I think with that kind of system, it's tough to start with a groundswell if you don't have that history behind it.
All right. I want to pick up something Ross said about, you know, maybe the office pool, but betting on sports is illegal in Georgia. We just want to say for the record, but it is kind of standard practice to try and predict the NCAA tournament's outcome. So are March Madness pools with friends and family really off limits?
As far as the law goes?
Yes.
I think so. I mean, do I partake? I won't answer that, but I know people.
I'm shocked that there is gambling going on in the back room.
Yeah, I think there are, like ESPN tournaments or CBS, there are chances to win prizes if you have the best bracket, you know, maybe win a car here, but you're not wagering anything. As far as family and friends go, if you keep it small, if you keep it, you know, civil and don't end up in court over a lost bet, it happens all the time. There are much larger issues in college sports that federal officials are interested in than whether or not somebody won or lost $10 on the bracket.
Very much so.
So this is not a bet, but which team do you think will win?
I'd have to put, if there was any sort of fictional money on the table, it would have to be on the university, or just Duke University. It has to be them. Zion Williamson, RJ Barrett, two of the top players coming into the NBA draft this season. You're going to see them in the NBA. They have the most horses. They have the most talent.
All right. Russ is harumphing and shaking his head back here.
I want to point out the word of the day yesterday on dictionary.com was bracketology. And that is a system of diagrammatically predicting and tracking the process of elimination in the NCAA tournament.
Right.
I don't think Taylor knows what that word means based on his pick. I learned this at a young age through the ice cream money that I lost. You never trust Duke in the NCAA tournament in a year like this. I'm taking North Carolina to beat Michigan State.
They won like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, but they didn't have the Zion hype. They didn't have this hype. I like Coach K, but I'm taking North Carolina. I'm also Ohio State. Watch
okay,
out.
How about which team are you rooting for? You know, maybe not win, but you'd love to see win.
Well, if we're talking in a world of fantasy, then the Georgia State Panthers all the way. I mean, they're gonna defy the odds.
Deep fantasy do you want to go here?
Well, even in my fantasy, in my bracket, I think I have them going to the round of 32. And that's about as far as they'll get, if they even get that far.
How about for you, Ross?
The Ohio State University. Watch out. I mean, they're not going anywhere. Let's be realistic. They had an up and down year. Their top player just came back from suspension. But Buckeyes at any given time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one for real question. Let's talk about Georgia basketball beyond the college game. The Atlanta Hawks having a pretty tough season, ranked near the bottom of the Eastern Conference. Do you think that affects interest in March Madness?
I think so. I mean, I think if you're a fan of the NBA and maybe you don't have much leanings towards college basketball, if you know your team, like a New York Knicks or Atlanta Hawks, are going to be towards the bottom of that NBA lottery, then you're basically scouting out what your future could look like. And so that adds level of excitement that if you're not affiliated with any of the colleges actually playing.
Okay, 30 seconds. The Hawks' poor showing means Atlanta will have a high draft pick for June. College players you'd like to see help the Hawks?
Zion Williamson, please.
Ja Morant, bring him in from Murray State.
All right, we'll let you guys duke it out from here. Ross Terrell, sorry, I said Duke.
Yeah, that was
and
nice.
Taylor Gantz. But to us, there are morning edition favorite producer and reporter and On Second Thought sports folks, and we really appreciate them joining us. And that is our show for today, On Second Thought, produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Kaslow is our engineer. Amy Kiley is our senior producer. We'll be back with more tomorrow of On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for listening.